All right, now we're going to continue with that proof that we were in the middle of about the Schleicher germs, but the next topic will be the local trace formula, mainly on the Lie algebra, but at the same time I gave references for the local trace formula on the group. So anyway, those are all the main ones I could think of. Anyway, back to what we were doing with the Schleicher germs, and let me write the basic equation. Well, all right, so we had the nilpotent orbits, R of them, and then remember we were writing mu sub 1, mu sub R for the orbital integrals over those unipotent orbits. And we also fixed the maximal torus, T, in the group G, and we were considering orbital integrals for regular elements, gamma, in T. And we normalize the orbital integrals for such guys in using a measure on the group and on the torus independent of the gamma. So kind of so now it makes sense to see what happens as a function of gamma. And here's the basic equation. We have the nilpotent orbital integrals of the function f and the Schleicher germs. All right, so recall that the rough nature of this thing is you have a fixed function f, you look at its orbital integrals as a function of the conjugacy class, and then as a function of the conjugacy class, it's a finite linear combination of these Schleicher germs, and the coefficients you have are the unipotent orbital integrals. All right, but actually the way this works is this is only valid once gamma is near the identity. So I'll just say it informally. This is for gamma near 1 in T regular. All right, so it's really just, and it's a neighborhood that depends on the function f. That's really the way it goes. All right, now we were making progress on proving that, and let me remind you of how we define those Schleicher germs. The way we did that was we picked some functions such that you get the Kronecker delta when you take all the various orbital unipotent orbital integrals of these things. The ith unipotent orbital integral of the j function is the Kronecker delta. And then what you do is take the orbital integrals for these elements gamma of those functions. All right, so this is the definition. The ith Schleicher germ, you take the ith function and take its orbital integrals. And that's about where we were at the end of last time. Okay, so what we have to check is that when we use these, let me repeat again, like last time, these functions aren't unique because we only specified the unipotent orbital integrals, which leaves a whole lot of room to change them. And that means these things aren't unique, but as we'll see during the course of the proof, the germs about the identity element are unique. For the theorem to be true, we have to get it in this way. And so it's unique. But we have to prove the theorem. All right, so consider this function that I'm going to write down now. It's a sum over the unipotent orbits, basically. Of the functions that we picked over here. So we take those functions, and then we form a linear combination of that finite collection of functions, whereas coefficients, we take the, we're working with some function now, okay, so fix a function, but form this linear combination of the functions f sub I using the unipotent orbital integrals of f. Why do we consider this thing? Because it has, by construction, the same unipotent orbital integrals as f. That's the point of this thing. This has, by construction, the same unipotent orbital integrals as F. Let me take the difference, which I will call phi. So phi is the difference. That difference then has zero unipotent orbital integrals for all orbits. All right. Mu I of phi equals zero for all I. Well, now I want to say that we can replace this function phi by a function all of whose orbital integrals are the same. So I want to change the function without changing its orbital integrals in such a way that the new function actually vanishes on the unipotent set. This, of course, is a weaker thing. This phi, its unipotent orbital integrals vanish, so the averages of the functional unipotent orbits are zero, but it doesn't mean they're zero. But we want to change it without changing the averages on any orbit, and have it actually vanish identically on the unipotent set. So how can we do this? Well, we have to consider the same kinds of exact sequences that we did before. Remember, we were writing some kind of script U for the unipotent set, which is closed in G. And this is, you know, remove it. So that's G with the unipotent stuff deleted, and that's an open in G. All right, so simply because we have an open and a complementary close, we get that. And then we can take these co-invariants, which then we will lose the exactness here, but it's okay. And let's think about what information we have about this function phi that we're trying to fiddle with. Where does it fit into this thing? Well, I can look at phi, it's a function on G, but let me maybe put square brackets around it or something. I can look at the class of that and the co-invariance. And our hypothesis, or not hypothesis, but this fact that we have here, that its unipotent orbital integrals are zero, that means it goes to zero here, because last time we analyzed G invariant distributions on the unipotent set, which is that the G invariant distributions on the unipotent set are just, they live in the dual vector space to this thing. And for something to be zero in this vector space just means when you take a basis for the dual vector space and evaluate it, you get zero all the time. Well, that's exactly the statement here. All right, so it does go to zero because of this. But that means it comes from something. Let's call it psi. So let's say that the function psi or its class maps to that thing. Well, psi is the desired function. Psi is a function that's supported on the complement of the unipotent set. So that means that psi, when you restrict it to the unipotent set, is identically zero. That's the function I wanted. And notice that it has the property that we wanted, because when you just view it as a function on G, it's the same in the co-invariance. And that means, dually, if you take phi and psi, any G invariant distribution on G will have the same values on them. The fact that this maps to this, that implies if we take for every G conjugation invariant distribution I of psi equals I of phi. So we haven't changed the orbital integrals of phi when we replace it by psi. Or in fact, all invariant distributions take the same value on the two things. Well, this is still, we're partway there now. This function psi is somehow, for our purposes, it's just phi and psi are just basically the same. And so we have, roughly speaking, the difference between F and this linear combination is something that vanishes on U. But we want to now say that that's going to mean that psi actually vanishes on something bigger. And here it's a little bit subtle. I mean, you would say, okay, psi is some compactly supported function. I mean, that's the kind of thing we're looking at. And the compact support of that thing is something closed that doesn't meet the unipotent set. So it's true, because you have a compact and a disjoint closed set, we could put an open set around the unipotent set that wouldn't meet that compact support. But we want more than that. I want to find a conjugation invariant open set around U that doesn't meet the support. That's a little bit harder. So we have to argue about that more carefully than just that simpler thing. So the claim is there, and this is what makes it necessary to think a little bit, there exists a G conjugation invariant open set containing the unipotent set such that psi restricted to that bigger thing is still identically zero. And to prove this, we need to actually do something that does involve a little bit the structure theory, although not in a very hard way. So here's the proof of the claim. There's a continuous map. I will say more about it in a second. I'm saying there exists a continuous map from G to a Hausdorff topological space. I'll give examples just in a second. Okay, continuous map from G to a Hausdorff topological space having the property that there's some point in that topological space called C0 such that the fiber over that point is just the unipotent set, so such that alpha inverse of C0 is just the unipotent set. And that's one condition. And what else do I need? I guess just the other thing is every fiber is a union of conjugacy classes. In this case, it was just the whole unipotent set precisely, but I want that every fiber is a union of G orbits. All right, or in other words, that the G action, the G conjugation, did I write it? I was having a moment of confusion there, because I just started to do, I've switched in my own mind to the Lie algebra, because the rest of this lecture will concern the Lie algebra. But it's all right, we're still in the group, actually. So it was correct in my notes. Very soon we'll be replacing all of these by Gothic ones. How do you construct this for GL2? Well, it's completely easy in that case. In GL2, suppose you've got a 2x2 matrix. Just call it G. Yeah. No. The unipotent set is a closed subset. It's a closed subset. And we will see it very clearly here in this example. Actually, it'll make it easy to see why that's true. Let's take as our map alpha, the map which associates the pair consisting of the trace and the determinant. Okay, trace G, comma det G. And now, for something to be unipotent, just means that it has the same trace and determinant as the identity matrix does. And yet for the identity matrix, of course, you would get 2, comma 1. All right, so the unipotent set is just alpha inverse of 2, comma 1. And that shows it's closed. I mean, last time I said the unipotent set was closed, well, now we see it from this construction. Now you can imagine what you do for GLN. You're going to go to the field to the power n, and instead of just using the trace and determinant, you use all the coefficients of the characteristic polynomial. And that's going to work equally well. And now if you have a general group G, you just embed it. So here's the general case. Just take G and take a faithful representation of this thing as an algebraic group. And then do what we just did on GLM, and then use the fact that an element in G is unipotent if and only if its image in G is unipotent. All right, but now we're in business because we look at the support of our function. What is our function? Psi. All right, so psi is this function that does vanish on the unipotent set. So the support of psi, when we apply alpha to it, the support misses the unipotent set, so alpha of it misses C0. All right, so this is, it doesn't contain C0. But anyway, it's compact, and this is continuous. So this whole thing is compact. So that thing is a compact set that does not contain C0. Its complement is an open set containing C0. I didn't give it a name here. I was looking for a G invariant open set V. Okay, and I'll put V to be alpha inverse of C with this compact set removed. And that does the job. All right. Now, because of the fact that this modified function psi actually vanishes in this fairly substantial neighborhood of the unipotent set, will tell us that, in fact, since it vanishes on entire orbits, when you integrate over those orbits, you get zero. So just by the way we've done things, for every gamma that's in V intersected with T regular, psi is identically zero on the orbit of gamma, hence the orbital integral is zero. And that means for such gamma, we have that when we look at the orbital integral for gamma of f, well, the orbital integrals of psi and phi are the same, and that just came from the difference between these things. So that means that the orbital integrals for f for gamma will be the same as that other thing there. So it means it'll be the same as sum from the thing that came up there, and we have the coefficients in the linear combination. And then we will have the orbital integrals of f sub I. But remember, that's by definition, that was the thing we were going to call the ith Schleicher germ. Okay, so we're done. That proves that we do have an expression for the orbital integrals of f as a linear combination of Schleicher germs, with the coefficients being the unipotent orbital integrals. So we're done. Well, there are other interesting things that can be said about Schleicher germs, but at least for now I'm going to leave them aside and start on the local trace formula. If there's more time later in the week, I may, as an application of some of the stuff that comes out of the local trace formula, we can actually do something interesting with Schleicher germs, but we'll see. I don't know. All right, so the next topic is the local trace formula. And I'll start off with the case of the group, because I want to tie things in with what we did on the very first day, which was to look at the case of a compact group, a local trace formula on the compact group, Peter Weyl theorem, and all that stuff. But then, once we see the kind of rough form of the beginning steps of that, we'll see that there's something analogous you can do on the Lie algebra, and that's what I'll actually focus on. All right, so as usual, F will be a p-adic field. Although the theory works in the real case, too, but I'm going to, when I actually start doing things that are non-trivial, it'll be in the p-adic case. All right, so usual stuff, connected reductive group, fix a Haar measure, and then we have as our functions the usual space, but we, once we fix the Haar measure, we can convolve them and have a convolution algebra of functions, locally constant, compact supported. And then, just like in the compact case, much of this stuff is the same. Of course, at some point it becomes different due to non-compactness, but the beginning things are the same. We can again look at L2 of the group G, and we've got two actions of G on there, one coming from right translation and one coming from left translation. And once again, the role of the two test functions F1 and F2 is the same. One of them will be doing a smear dot version of left translation, and one will be doing a smear dot version of right translation. All those things are the same. So as in compact case, get from F1, F2 an operator on L2G. And it again has a kernel function, with kernel function given by the same formula as before. All those things, calculations were quite formal in nature. They won't change. X inverse GY DG. Okay, everything exactly the same as in the compact case. That was our kernel then. Of course, now comes the big difference. That's a function on G cross G. And G cross G isn't compact anymore. So this kernel function isn't square integrable. And the corresponding operator is not Hilbert-Schmidt, and so on. I mean, and well, this one really involves both of them. And before I was able to argue that that this thing gave a trace class operator. I mean, that's not true either. I mean, all those things are not going to be right anymore. So not trace class anymore. Well, the procedure that Arthur uses to deal with this situation is, I mean, it's again a truncation procedure where what we if the thing had been, if everything was like the compact case, what would we have done? We would have taken a diagonal, set y equal to x, and then integrated over x. Well, what Arthur actually does is, again, takes y equal to x, so you get some function of just one variable x, then truncates it in a simple way just by multiplying it by the characteristic function of something to cut to make the integral converge, and then just does the integral. All right. But as I say, I want to actually shift. I wouldn't be able to give a very self-contained presentation of the local trace formula on a group because it involves it involves some fairly non-trivial things on the group, unfortunately, on the spectral side. And it would involve too much preliminary discussion. But on the Lie algebra, you have the advantage that the two sides, kind of geometric and spectral, if you can call it spectral, in a sense, they're the same. But although the spectral side really is the spectral side because it involves Fourier transforms of orbital integrals rather than orbital integrals. In a sense, those are the spectral things. But anyway, what I want to what I want to do is switch to the Lie algebra, where you see the geometric side just as well. Moreover, the method of truncation is exactly the same. And the key thing to understand the geometric side in the group case, the key lemma, is exactly the same. So you actually don't lose too much. To understand the geometric side in the group case, it's really the same problem. All right, but now I do want to, here's our group G, but now I want to introduce its Lie algebra. Okay, so G is the Lie algebra. That's just the Lie algebra over our p-adic field F. And we consider the adjoint action on it. And now let's just take what we would have had before. All right, so KXX. This is the thing we would now truncate and integrate in the group case. So KXX is just integral over G, F1 of G, F2X inverse GX. Now, it makes a big difference in the sense that in the Lie algebra case, it's not clear what the Lie algebra analog of this thing should be because of the X inverse GY. That somehow doesn't sound a good thing from the point of view of the Lie algebra. But you can just stare at this thing and see that there's an obvious Lie algebra analog of this expression because this involves a conjugation, which can be thought of as just adjoint action. All right, so the Lie algebra analog of this is, let me just call it K of X. So this is now a definition. I've jumped to Lie algebra, and this is simply the definition of the quantity we're going to consider. Change the group to the Lie algebra, and then we'll have a function on the Lie algebra, and we'll be integrating of the Lie algebra, so capital X is the variable in the Lie algebra. We'll have F2, and now we need to so X is simply we're giving the value at the point X, and the way it enters in is you conjugate the element in the Lie algebra. In other words, you use the adjoint action. And then you integrate over the Lie algebra. That thing is the element. Little x is in the group. So this little x is in the group. All right? Thanks. That's exactly right. Yeah, it's only the one variable that gets changed to the Lie algebra variable. The other one stays in the group. Well, now in the, of course, let me come back to the group case. We got a kernel over here just from the nature of the convolution action. But of course, the other thing you do when you're working in the group and you do the spectral side is you have to break up the L2 space of G according to the irreducible tempered representations of G. And then it's no longer a direct sum like in the compact case, but direct integral of those things. But somehow you still, in our Lie algebra case, you still have some kind of analog of that. All right, we don't want to think about, what am I trying to say? We need some replacement for the other side. I mean, in the group case, we would have the kernel thought about one way equal to the kernel thought about another way, the second way involving irreducible tempered representations of the group G. And we need an analogous thing here. We need for this thing to be equal to something else, and it should be equal to something else that somehow involves duality, as in between the duality on a group between conjugacy classes and irreducible characters. We need some kind of Fourier kind of duality. And here, you just write the following thing. This can also be, this is also the same by the Poincaré theorem on the Lie algebra. The Lie algebra is an additive group. You can do Fourier analysis on the additive group of that Lie algebra. It's a vector space. It's an additive group. You can do Fourier analysis like in Tate's thesis or something. And we'll do that Fourier analysis, and one of the things you have is the Poincaré theorem. That means that the integral, and I'm going to write it this way. Again, it'll be an integral over the Lie algebra, but we essentially replace these things by their Fourier transforms. Now, in the Poincaré theorem, you usually do it with complex conjugates in it to have L2 norms. I'm going to write it a different way. I'm going to have just two versions of the Fourier transform, one with a hat and one with a check. Which one? This is a big one. Yeah, I mean, let me say it in words. What's the nature of the quantity k of x? We're given these two, oh, I didn't write it, I'm sorry. F1 and F2, I should have specified their functions. Locally constant, compact, and supported on the Lie algebra, as you might guess. But we take the function F1, and we take not F2, but we conjugate it by the group element G. And then we take, then we integrate the one against the other. So we're integrating a given function f against all the various conjugates of the other function, and then regarding that as a function of the thing by which you conjugated. That's what we're doing. But it's equal to this. Now, what are these Fourier transforms? When I write it like this, remember, with a Fourier transform, you always have to decide whether you put in the additive character psi or do you put in psi inverse. Well, I'm going to put in psi for my additive character with the hat and psi inverse with a check. So those are the things that are inverse to each other. F hat, the most standard Fourier transform, is integrate of the Lie algebra, the function. Let's say we need a new variable, say x prime, psi, that's an additive character, killing form, x prime. Dx prime. And this thing needs to be a self-dual, that's sort of a fine point, self-dual Haar measure, so that Fourier inversion works right. As I say, B is the killing form on the Lie algebra that lets you identify the Lie algebra with the dual of the Lie algebra. Well, okay. This is if G is semi-simple. If G is not semi-simple, then you just need a symmetric bilinear form that's non-degenerate and which is G invariant. All right? So what you really need is a G invariant, non-degenerate, symmetric bilinear form. SBF is symmetric bilinear form. And psi, that's a non-trivial additive character. Psi maps the additive group of F to C star. Non-trivial. The usual thing you do in Fourier analysis on local fields. All right, I think everything has been explained now. And when I do the F hat, as I already explained, it's the same, but you just use, it's ditto, but you use psi inverse. And when you do that, then those two operations with the hat and with the check, they're inverses to each other, the Fourier transform and the inverse Fourier transform. And if you don't want to use complex conjugates, which I don't, then you need to state this, I think it's called Parseval's equality. I can never remember which one is which, but this equality of L2 interproducts, I prefer to state it this way. Well, anyway, we now have the same thing, but like in the usual trace, all the trace formulas, we have the same thing, but written two different ways. Now you truncate both of them in the same way and integrate, and you get an equality of two different things that then has to be processed further. Yeah. So just I won't write anything, but if we were in the case of a compact p-adic group which can arise, then we wouldn't need to truncate. We'd be all right. We could simply we would simply integrate both sides of this formula over G, and that integral would be well behaved if the, in the compact case. But if the group is non-compact, we need to do something about it. All right, so we're going to truncate, and as I said, the truncation procedure actually is identical to the one used in the local trace formula on the group, but different from the one used in the global trace formula in the number field case, anyway. Probably there's something, I think in the function field, global function field case, there's probably something similar to this local one. All right, well, I'm going to explain things just, it, you know, if you know the structure theory for groups by heart, then what I'm doing now you won't find it hard to get rid of these things, but just so that we have a minimum of structure theory to worry about, I will discuss things in the split case. Again, make G split over O, and let's have all these things over O. That's a Borel and a maximal torus in that Borel. Let's just do all those things. And as I've done before, let's take K to be our standard compact open subgroup G of O. And then, as before, we'll get this Cartan decomposition, which we're going to need for the truncation. Let me recall that. The K double cosets, we already discussed it, especially for GL2. The K double cosets come from dominant coweights. And in the case of GL2, just to tie it in, a dominant coweight was given by a pair of integers with the one bigger than the other, and it went to the double coset pi to the m pi to the n. Well, in general, you do a similar thing, and you send a coweight to, and it's a double coset containing pi is now a uniformizing element in our local field. And pi to the power mu, you can kind of see why people often write it that way from these examples. You sort of think about the mu as giving you the exponents to which you have to raise the pi if you're thinking into some kind of classical group. But strictly speaking, what it means is pi mu is, by definition, just the value of the mu is a co-character, and it's the value of that co-character on pi, so it sits inside of A. And now we need some things that probably are going to be familiar from the global case. I'm going to try to stick with notation that's like in Arthur's papers, and he tends to use the same notation both in the local and global case. All right, so let's take the co-character group for A and turn it into a real vector space. The subscript R means just tensor that lattice with the real numbers to get a real vector space. This is the usual real vector space where you get the co-roots and co-characters sitting. Now, inside of there, we need this subspace. Again, it's Arthur's kinds of, I'm trying to use Arthur's system. These are the come from co-characters of A that actually come from the center of G. But again, tensor, that would be a lattice, but now tensor it with the real numbers. Okay, so AG, as usual, well, in a split group, usually AG means the split component of the center. But our group is split, so it's actually just the center, except that might be disconnected. So it's the identity component of the center, and that's the biggest torus contained in the center of the group, and it will sit inside of A. All right, now we can form the quotient vector space, A mod AG. So for GL3, that quotient will be two-dimensional. It's the usual thing that you draw when you draw the root system for GL3. We'll have a two-dimensional vector space, root hyperplanes in it, and coroutes sitting inside of it. All right, so we have, well, one thing, simple coroutes give a basis for this vector space, and the simple roots give basis for the dual vector space. All right, and so you can take the vanishing set of a root and get a hyperplane in this vector space that we're working with. And now we need a partial order. Let me draw the picture. All right, I want the usual kind of partial order you put on coweights, or here, actually, we've tensored things with the real numbers, and I'll use the partial order on that vector space. But if we take some point out here, t, I'll be using t in a minute for truncation parameter, despite the fact that t also gets used for maximal torus, but you'll have to let context decide. So t is a point in this vector space, and now I want to draw the, this is GL3, where, as I say, the quotient space there is actually a two-dimensional vector space. The things that are less than or equal to the sky are the usual things. Now, there's the negative of a simple coroute that goes in this direction. There's the negative of a simple coroute that goes in this direction. And then you just get all the stuff in this cone. So that's a picture of the things that are less than or equal to t. This is t prime, such that t prime is less than or equal to t. What's the official definition? T1 less than or equal to t2 means that t2 minus t1 is a non-negative linear combination of simple coroutes. I already said the simple coroutes give you a basis, so anything is going to be a linear combination with real coefficients. But when the coefficients are non-negative, then we say less than equal means of simple coroutes. All right, and that's exactly what I was saying, because those are the negatives of the simple coroutes are going that way. Well, now we can say what function we use to truncate with. Let me draw my GL3 picture again. The truncation parameter t, I want it to be dominant. I want it to be in the positive vial chamber. And so let's just say we've picked a positive vial chamber. Let's say that one's the positive one. And then we'll have, just as I drew before, I'll put it in the same location. So t. All right, so t is dominant. T is something in the vector space, A mod AG. Dominant, i.e., in positive vial chamber. Remember, I fixed a Borel, and so we have a notion of positive roots, simple roots, positive vial chamber, all that stuff, because we fixed a Borel B a while back. All right, so there's a picture of a T that's okay. And now I want to consider all the things that are dominant that are less than or equal to that thing. So it's related to this picture. I want less than or equal, but to be dominant. So So it'll just be in this region here and then cut off by that. Okay, so this is a picture of dominant elements that are less than or equal to T. It's a picture of T prime, such that T prime dominant and T prime less than or equal to T. Now, I want to come back to this Cartan decomposition. The K double cosets are indexed by co-characters, and I'm going to take dominant co-characters. And those can be, maybe I should put it here, you know, we have X lower star of A. That just is a lattice inside of this vector space A. And then that maps to the quotient vector space, like so. So if I've got one of these co-characters, dominant co-characters mu, then it gives me something in that positive Weyl chamber. Let's say it's dominant. So, you know, yes, that's okay. All of them are okay, because the boundary is here is, those are considered to be dominant, and the boundary here are allowed because I said non-negative and not positive. So all the boundaries are included. All right, so it makes sense then, I can form the following thing. I can look at the disjoint union of those K double cosets, K, pi, mu, K, where I just, so mu is, if I write this, I'll have the whole group, because that's the Cartan decomposition. I would have the whole group expressed as a disjoint union of things. But now we limit it. So we require such that mu is less than or equal to T. And of course, I don't really mean mu. I mean the image of mu. Maybe so let's say once we've mapped it to here that we call it mu bar. We'll maybe put mu bar there. All right, that thing is it's a subset of G that's almost compact. It's not quite compact. It's actually because of the effect of the center. If our group is semi-simple, that thing actually would be compact, because in the semi-simple case, you can just say, well, in this picture here, the mu gives us lattice points, and we would have a finite number of lattice points in this region. In the semi-simple case, that would be just a finite collection. But we mod it out by the center. And in the general case, that means that this set is only compact modulo the center, or modulo AG. Okay, so this resolving thing is a subset of G, which is compact modulo A sub G. In other words, when you project it into the quotient space, G modulo A sub G, it is compact. Now we're going to consider the characteristic function of that set and use that to truncate to, as the thing we'll truncate with. All right, so I need the characteristic function of that. Let me introduce a name for it. And again, it'll be Arthur's notation. Oh, one thing I should say as I'm erasing this. When I do these things on the Lie algebra, I'll be following Arthur's method rather than the one in Valls-Berger, because what Valls-Berger does in that paper that's listed in the references is to deduce the Lie algebra case from the group case. Instead of doing that, I'm just transposing the proof in the group case to the Lie algebra. Otherwise, we wouldn't see the mechanism that's common to both things. Anyway, let's make this definition. We have our truncation parameter, and then G is a variable in the group, and that's just the characteristic function of that set. Oh, this is characteristic function of the set. that we just considered. Okay, so it's not quite compact. It's the characteristic function of a set that's compact, knob the center. But that will be good enough for us. Well, I already told you what the plan was. We're going to multiply both sides of this thing by that characteristic function. Well, in the compact case, we got to integrate over the group G. Notice that in this integral, it's obvious because of this conjugate, because how does the variable x enter in here? All it does is conjugate this thing. So certainly the value of this function on x here, if you change x by something in the center, it doesn't change. So this function really only depends on x modulo a sub g, which means it's much more reasonable, and that's what we have to do, is we will integrate over g modulo a sub g. And then it's fine because we truncated with something that's compact, modulo a sub g. Anyway, so we make as a definition now. Let me put the f1 and the f2 in. Those are the functions we started with. The truncation parameter, k, just because that gets used for kernel and then ends up being the name for this thing. By definition, we integrate over actually not g, but g modulo the ag. And we put in this characteristic function to truncate it. And other than that, just copy what came from before. Although maybe, yeah, I guess I switched from little x to little g to make a bigger distinction between the group element and the Lie algebra element. This integral is convergent in the best possible way. I've written it as an iterated integral, but it actually is convergent as a double integral, just for completely simple reasons. I mean, when you think about the integrand, the whole integrand involving all the factors, it's compactly supported on the product of those two guys, and so you're okay. So this is a convergent double integral. The best sense, convergent as double integral. So you can manipulate it in any way you want. There's no difficulties in switching orders of integration or anything you want to do. Okay, now what's the formula? That's just one side of the formula. But we saw over here that the other side of the formula is actually the same thing, except you just change the functions. And so certainly the formula says, so the first very crude form, first crude local trace formula on Lie algebra would just state the equality of this thing and the parallel thing where you insert the Fourier transforms. But as just as in the global case, this is not so useful because we don't yet see anything, we don't have any sense of what these actual, what the integral actually looks like. So this is a crude form, and it's not the final form by any means. It has to be, we have to keep modifying things. But that's the starting point. All right. Now, because, as I said, this is actually one of the main reasons why I switched to the local trace formula of the Lie algebra for the purposes of these talks, it's that we only have one thing to do, because the two sides are really, in a sense, the same. So I don't need to worry about the spectral side, because it's really like the other side. That means if we can just understand the left side, that's good enough. And then, of course, at the same time, we will have understood the right side, and eventually we'll have a better formula. Okay, now, the very first thing to do is to get a better understanding of what this thing actually looks like. And here it's quite helpful to think of what happened in the compact, in the case that we did a long time ago, of a compact group, where we didn't have to worry about this kind of thing here. We actually express things in terms of an integral of, and then we had the orbital integrals of the first function and the orbital integrals of the second function, multiplied together and then integrated up. All right, so basically we had some conjugacy class, we integrated both functions over that same conjugacy class, and then integrated over the set of conjugacy classes at the end, more or less, that's what happened. So here, again, we want to separate things out into the, we want to get the contributions of things according, you know, of the capital X's here. We want to lump together capital X's that are in the same orbit. So the first thing we have to do is to kind of look orbit by orbit, and then at the end integrate over all the orbits. But of course, that, there's a name for that procedure. So we need the Weyl integration formula, which is a way of doing an integral on, in this case, the Lie algebra, but there's a similar thing on the group. It's a way of doing an integral on the Lie algebra as first integrate over the conjugacy classes and then integrate those results to get the integral over the whole thing. Okay, so we need the Weyl integration formula to go further. So let me recall just a bit about how that works. So as I warned you, unfortunately, T now means something completely different. So again, a maximal torus having nothing to do with the truncation parameter. But we look at its Lie algebra, which I'll write as a little t. That's supposed to be some kind of Gothic little t. I just can't make it look too convincing. We need another thing, namely there's a Weyl group associated to T. I don't want the absolute Weyl group. This thing can be smaller. It's a subgroup of it. Namely, and here, although I usually omit p-adic points so as to prevent the possibility of any confusion, here I'm going to explicitly put in here, you look at the things in G of F that normalize the torus, modulo the F points of that torus. So that's a subgroup of the absolute Weyl group. Okay, we need that. And now you need to think about the following map. Okay, we're trying to analyze the Lie algebra in terms of its orbits. And you can look at things that are conjugate to something in the Lie algebra of T. So that's what we do. We take something that's in the Lie algebra of T, call it X, say, and take a group element, and we send that pair to the conjugate, G inverse XG. All right, so the image of this map will just be all the guys in the Lie algebra that are conjugate to something in the torus. Then what you have to do is calculate the differential of this map and its Jacobian. Okay, so one needs to calculate the differential, calculate the Jacobian. Doesn't really become meaningful to talk about a Jacobian unless you're saying what volume forms you're using to calculate a number with, because really the Jacobian is a map between top exterior powers, but you have to trivialize those and then you get a number. But it's kind of clear what we should do. As a volume form here, just take a translation invariant. So on these guys, take translation invariant volume forms. So when I say volume form, I just mean a differential form of top degree. And on here, that's a homogeneous space. So we should take a volume form on there that's G invariant. And I want them to be compatible. Because when we look at the base point here, let me just say it without writing it down. When we look at the base point here, the tangent space is going to be Gothic G modulo Gothic T. Here we have Gothic T, here we have Gothic G. There's a kind of obvious compatibility in top exterior powers. You want the thing you're using here to be the wedge product of the one you use here and the one you use there at the base point. That makes sense, and it gives a compatibility. All right, so do that. Take your volume forms to be as nice as possible and make them compatible, and calculate the Jacobian. What do you get? The Jacobian, when you do the calculation, is plus or minus the determinant of little ab of x. So we have an element x. The Jacobian is independent of g. It turns out the Jacobian at this point, g comma x, only depends upon the second variable x. And it's the determinant of the adjoint action of x. Well, if I took that determinant, it'd be zero because you'd have some zero eigenvalues. But what we do is we don't look at ab of x on all of the Lie algebra. We look on the Lie algebra mod t, the same thing that came up as the tangent space here. We look at the base point. The adjoint action of x preserves t, and therefore it induces a linear map on g mod t, and you look at the determinant of that linear map. Now this determinant has a name. That determinant I'll write d. You can think d for determinant, but in the case of GLN, it ends up being a discriminant. And so I think actually traditionally, I think it meant discriminant, and that's why people always use D. Anyway, sorry, I went over for a minute. Okay, what's the question?
So, firstly, you didn't say that there was a unique set of the terms of gamma I.
It comes from the proof. So think about what the proof gives, and you'll see that. Okay?
Is the theorem true in positive characteristic
evaluation? I can't remember. That's a short answer to that one. Okay, so we asked if the same, probably didn't hear either one. So the first question was, did I really prove the uniqueness part of the statement about the Schleicher germs? And it's implicit in the proof. If you think through the proof, you'll see that it was okay. Second question is, how do things work in characteristic P when your local field is of characteristic P? The answer, I forget. I'm not sure I ever knew. I don't know. I can't answer it.